I really encourage you to study this book, commend it to you for your time. It's a good book to spend some time in devotionally. It's a good book to draw a lot of wisdom from. Some of the things that Solomon is sharing with us may not be true from God's point of view, but from man's point of view, they appear to be true. And so in our studying this book, there are basically two conclusions that we can come to. One, in chapters 1 through 6, and this forms the logical division in the book, in chapters 1 through 6, Solomon is telling us, as one who had really experienced it all, he had all that money could buy, he was worth many millions of dollars in our money in that day, perhaps the wealthiest man who ever lived, certainly so in the ancient world. And yet Solomon, with all of his money and could have everything, he experienced everything, and he found out that it was like chasing after the wind. And I think that's why the Lord had him pen this book down, so that we would not spend our lives chasing after the wind. It's particularly a good book for young people, but a good book for all of us who are trying to find our way through this maze and haze in life and find out what's really valuable and what isn't. Where should we spend our time? What should our priorities be? And Solomon is saying, I guarantee you this ought not to be a priority. Chapter 1, human knowledge. He said, I thought that would answer all my questions and it would be the answers to all the world's problems if we could just get everybody educated. But he said, I found out that too is like chasing after the wind. Then in chapter 2, he turns to another venture, and that is wealth, the pursuit of wealth and all that wealth would buy him. Primarily, he's speaking here of wine, works, wealth, and women in chapter 2. And he concludes in chapter 2 by saying all that, too, is chasing after the wind. There's no value to it. It's empty. Chapter 3, the conclusion he makes regarding political successes and, again, riches, which seems to be a key statement in this book because usually the men who have money are the men who experience most of these things. It's extremely difficult even in our day to be a successful politician if you don't have the money. So naturally we see them all going together. Solomon says, political successes, regardless of how powerful a man may become politically, it can all end overnight. A younger man take his place. That's what he's saying in the latter part of chapter 3. So he said, what value is there to it? And we've seen so many in our day who have been on in a very important place politically only to have it end overnight. And then you wonder why you spent all of that effort and all that time and had such a drive to get to the top and only be there for such a short time. I commend to you the reading of Charles Colson's book, Born Again, in case you have any desire yourself to somehow make it to the top by hook or by crook. In chapter, that didn't come out quite the way I meant it to. Chapter 5, then, Solomon gives us a lot of wisdom regarding money. And he makes three very important statements. I shared these last week. This is kind of a summary, but I know most of you were not here last week because of the Super Bowl, so I felt like I had to go over some of this. Chapter 5 and verse 10, he gives us the very first statement regarding money, and that is that money never satisfies. Chapter 5 and verse 10, the more money that a man has, the more he wants. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. That is, if your goal is money, you're driving life is to have money, you're never going to be satisfied with money. That's interesting, isn't it? That's a really good observation. That's keen insight. If your love is for money, then you're never going to be satisfied with money. Solomon says, I know because I've been there. Chapter 5 and verse 13 and 14, he makes the second statement regarding money, and that is that it may be lost. It's a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. So Solomon is saying, not only does money not satisfy, but it may be lost. So it's not a very stable thing upon which to build your life. It doesn't make a very good foundation. And that's good for us to know when we're young in life. Then the third statement is found in chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, and that is that money may not be able to be enjoyed, even though a man has it. That's what he says in verse 2. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, but God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. What he means by that is a man may be in a position where, even though he's got a lot of money, he's loaded, as we would say, he doesn't have the power to be able to enjoy that wealth. Now, you and I can name many men who have been in that position. Last week I mentioned a man by the name of John D. Rockefeller, father of Nelson Rockefeller and Winthrop and all the boys who've had so much money. John D. Rockefeller, at age 50, had an ulcer so bad that all he could do was just taste little samples of food. And yet he was the wealthiest man in the world. More recently, a man by the name of Howard Hughes. A lot of wealth, and yet he lived the life of a hermit. God had not given him the power to be able to enjoy it. So there are many like that who, though they have it, they cannot really enjoy it. So Solomon says, why make that your goal in life, to have something that never satisfies, that you might lose, or that you can't enjoy? It just doesn't make sense. Solomon says, I've been there, I've experienced it, and I'm telling you by way of personal testimony, that's not where it's at. Now that's his conclusion in chapters 1 through 6. He mentions all the different philosophies, the philosophy of hedonism, as we said last week, where you just simply live for the moment. Whatever feels good, do it. But Solomon says, that's like chasing after the wind. And so his conclusion, the favorite phrase used over and over in the first 6 chapters, is the phrase, all is vanity, or chasing after the wind. Now, beginning with chapter 7, because Solomon has sort of demolished here our thinking in these areas, he's trying to get us to restructure our thinking. He's taking us now into a new area, and that is giving us some godly counsel in lieu of the uncertainty of life. And so that's what he begins to do in chapter 7. The favorite phrase from chapter 7 on is a little phrase, better than, better than. He says, now I'm giving you some godly choices here, things that are better than. In fact, 8 times here in the first 8 verses of chapter 7, you'll see that phrase used. A good name is better than a good ointment. Verse 2, it's better to go to a house of mourning. We mentioned 10 godly choices last week that Solomon encourages us to make. One is, he said, if you've got your choice, go to a funeral rather than a festival or a party. Interesting, isn't it? The world says, no, I'm going to go to a party. Let's forget about the funeral. Let's forget about it. Let's try to forget about death. Let's just push it out and hope that maybe somehow we'll never encounter it. Or when we get to be that age, they'll have a cure for it. So we won't have to die. The world sort of shoves it out of their mind. But Solomon says, no, go to a funeral if you've got your chance. Why? Because in verse 2, he said, this is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. When you see a loved one laying there in the casket, it's a reminder to all of us that one day we're going to go that same route. So he says it's the living who take it to heart, will bring their priorities back into proper perspective. It's the living who will profit from that. So you ought to go to a funeral every chance you get. Go to a funeral rather than a festival, because that's the end of every man. And to go to a festival, that gives you an unreal view of life. You're living in an unreal world. No, the funeral's where it's really at. That's the beginning of the real world. Godly counsel, isn't it? The second thing he says is choose a rebuke over comedians, verses 5 through 8. You've got your chance, he said. Listen to the rebuke of a wise man in verse 5 rather than to listen to the song of fools. Or a more contemporary expression would be comedians. What does the world do? They say, I mentioned this last week, comedians say, you know, if I can only make people laugh, then I've succeeded in what I want to do. And so if a comedian is successful in bringing a smile to your face, he feels like he's done his job and his life is fulfilled. Isn't that right? And so the world hires comedians to entertain. That's the way the world does it. But Solomon says, no. He says, it's much better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to go and listen to the song of fools. It's like burning thorns, crackling thorns under a pot. Furnishes temporary relief, but thorns burn up so rapidly. It's only temporary relief, and that's what the world has, just temporary relief through the use of comedians. So he says, that's not where it's at. It's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. Choose patience over anger, verses 8 and 9. The end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness. Choose the present, not the former days, verses 10 through 14. Why is it we always mourn for the former days, the 50s, when things were really good, whether they were or not, but that's when we say things were really good. Why do we always desire for the past rather than the present? Solomon says the present is where God has you. These are the days that He has made for you. Don't mourn or wish for the past. Then he says, choose godliness over self-righteousness in verses 15 through 18. Don't be self-righteous, be godly. Keep a balance in your life, verses 17 and 18. Sixthly, he says, choose self-restraint over the natural impulses, verse 19. Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Indeed, there's not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. The next statement he makes is, choose God's wisdom over human wisdom in verses 23 through 26. And then in chapter 8, verses 1 through 5, choose obedience over rebellion. If you've got that choice, always choose to be obedient rather than to rebel. The world will rebel at the least little problem. Solomon says, choose obedience. Verses 6 through 9. Of chapter 8. Choose eternity over time. Remember, time will not last forever. It will ultimately be dissolved into eternity. So if you've got your choice, live for eternity and not for time, and we certainly have that choice. Choose the fear of God over wickedness in verses 10 through verse 17. Choose to be fearful of the Lord, verse 12. Still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear Him openly. So these are 10 choices that Solomon gives us here in this passage. Now I want to look at verses 16 and 17 for tonight, and then look at, just very quickly, chapter 9. In verses 16 and 17, Solomon kind of concludes this section on choices by saying, "When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on the earth, even though one should never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, 'I know,' he cannot discover." I want to read that for you in the Good News Translation, which I think brings it out a little more clearly. Verse 17 particularly of chapter 8. Verse 16, "Whenever I tried to become wise and learn what goes on in the world, I realized that you could stay awake night and day and never be able to understand what God is doing. However hard you try, you will never find out. Wise men may claim to know, but they don't." What Solomon is saying here is that God is sovereign. We'll never really be able to figure out what God is doing and why He is doing it. And one of the things that often troubled me, and not long ago I sat in a restaurant eating lunch with a fella who, a middle-aged fella, and really trying to put life back together, not too many weeks ago. And one of the things he asked me, he said, "Well, I've got all these questions, you know, I'm searching," but he said, "I've got all these questions, and one of the questions is this, what about the heathen who've never heard about Jesus Christ?" That old, good old standby question we often throw in there. And I used to be almost apologetic and saying, "Well, you know, God's got a reason for that," and so forth, and try to figure out why this was. But I think, on the other hand, we have to honestly admit that there are things we do not know about God, we cannot give answers to. And I don't think we have to be apologetic for that, because there's no man in his field of study that still reaches a point at which he has no answers. Any honest scholar will tell you that he doesn't know everything that there is to know in his area. So we don't have to be apologetic when it comes to sort of standing up for God and defending God. God's capable of defending Himself. And I think we can honestly admit there are things we do not know about the ways of God, and that's what Solomon is saying here, that man cannot fully understand or know the ways of God. And when you tell someone you do not understand all of God's ways, you are not weakening your Christian testimony. In fact, I believe you're strengthening it. Every scientist has to make the same admission about his area of study or expertise. Now, there are things that seem to bother Solomon about the ways of God, and they're given to us in chapter 9, and I'm just going to mention three of them tonight. three things that really bother Solomon about the ways of God. And I'm sure these are things that perplex you as well. The first one is given to us in verses 1 through 10 of chapter 9. And that is simply stated as this. As Solomon sees it, and remember he's seeing it from a limited perspective. I used the illustration last week, and since most of you weren't here last week, I'll use it again. How many weren't here last week? Would you raise your hand? Oh, look at that. Half the church. You were the Super Bowl fans that weren't here. Well, anyway, you've watched a basketball game on TV, and you'll notice how when that camera's down on the floor, you have a very limited view of what's going on. You can only see a portion of that game. But when you have that camera up overhead and you're looking down, then you can see all the players and the way that they're moving and the patterns and so forth and what's happening in the game. Now, likewise, Solomon, as he's looking out, he's giving us his viewpoint from a human perspective. But on the other hand, if we could see things as God sees them, then we would see them differently. But Solomon here is just voicing some honest questions that he would like some answers to as a man. And that's what he's giving us in chapter 9. The first thing that he states in verses 1 through 10 is that there seems to be one fate for all men. One fate for all men. Whether a man's good, righteous, or whether he's bad, he's a sinner. Verse 2, it's the same for all. There's one fate for the righteous, for the wicked, for the good, for the clean, for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice, for the one who does not. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. This is an evil, Solomon says. There's an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. Now he's saying that death is the great leveler of men. And it doesn't seem to matter whether a man is righteous or unrighteous. He's still going to die. He's still going to suffer the same fate. Now, that's a question we all face, isn't it? We just simply don't know why God allows unrighteousness to go on. And why sometimes it's the righteous man at age 35 or 40 who will die of cancer, but the unrighteous man continues to sow the seeds of unrighteousness and God spares him. Why is that? And we conclude with Solomon, we just simply don't understand the ways of God. My ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. But we do know that God has a reason, that He is sovereign, that He's behind all things. Death certainly is the universal leveler of men. Verses 4 through 6. From the natural man's perspective, it is better to be alive than to be dead. Again, Solomon seeing it from the human viewpoint. And I think we would agree with that if it wasn't for the knowledge we have of Christ. Look what he says in verse 4. Whoever is joined with the living, there's hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion, for the living know that they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, and their zeal have already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun. That's why at a funeral we can only say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Why? Because he's gone. He's gone. From a human viewpoint, it certainly looks like the living are better off than the dead. And that's why most people who are apart from Christ want to hang on to every breath they have. They don't want to die because the natural thing is to say that the living are better off than the dead. So in verses 7 through 10, Solomon just says, again as a man, you might as well go out and enjoy yourself. You know, just enjoy yourself. Live life to the fullest. Eat your bread in happiness. Drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. In other words, things are not going to change. Let your clothes be white all the time. That is feasting. Let not the oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun, for this is your reward in life and your toil in which you have labored under the sun. I'm always interested in Solomon's counsel regarding women. You know, with, what was it, 300 wives and 700 concubines, I think it was. You really should know a lot, but I heard Zsa Zsa Gabor speak here one time not too long ago at a local mall, and you would think she'd be an authority on men, but she didn't appear to be. The second statement that Solomon makes that he just simply doesn't understand is that time and chance are a second great factor that we have to reckon with. Verses 11 and 12, he says, time and chance. Again, I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift. Now, do you see what he's saying here? The race is not to the swift or to the fastest runner. Fastest runner does not always win. You know, he pulls a muscle or something else. The battle is not to the warrior. The best warriors do not always win. He said, I don't understand that. It just seems to me, from a human perspective, that it ought to always be the fastest runner who wins, and it ought to always be the best warriors to win. And neither is bread to the wise. The wise man is often the one who's going hungry, nor wealth to the discerning. Many times, those who have the greatest wealth are those who have the least discernment, from a human viewpoint, nor favor to men of ability. Often the men of ability are overlooked. The old saying, it all depends on who you know. For time and chance, Solomon says, overtakes them all. He says, I don't understand this about the ways of God. Time and chance seem to affect a man's life, and this bothers him. The third thing, then, that really bothers Solomon from a human perspective is the fickleness of man in verses 13 through 15. Also this I came to see as wisdom under the sun. It impressed me that there was a small city with few men in it. A great king came to it, surrounded it, constructed large siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. Interesting little illustration here that Solomon is giving us. Yet no one remembered this poor man. Isn't that incredible? Here was a man who was responsible for delivering the city, and yet no one remembered him. Everybody forgot him because he was poor. And then he makes three statements about wisdom coming from this. And that is, first of all, that wisdom is better than strength in verse 16. I said wisdom is better than strength, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised and his words are not heeded. Verse 17, there's a second thing about wisdom, and that is that the words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. And then thirdly, in verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys so much good. I think what Solomon begins to drive at, and we'll see this as we get into chapters 11, 12, and 13, which we're going to finish next week, is this very thought, that the person who sees life from the perspective of faith can have a great impact upon society and those around him. That's really the conclusion that Solomon comes to. It doesn't sound like it at this point in the book. When we get towards the end, you'll see that. The person who has faith, who sees life from the perspective of faith, can have a great influence on those around him, and a great impact upon others. This was illustrated in World War II when a young man was in was out in the front lines of battle, and the company that he was with occupied a new area. And it so happened that as they were making the capture of this new area, that they ran across an old dilapidated building, and they were jubilant because they found a case of liquor in that building. And the guys, because they had met with a certain amount of success, decided here was the perfect opportunity for them to just sort of take advantage of the moment and drink up all of that liquor and get drunk and enjoy themselves that night after the battle they thought was won. But there was one young man there in that company who felt very uneasy about it. And so he discouraged them, and he discouraged the commander of the company from allowing these guys to drink the liquor. And the commander decided it would not be wise under the circumstances, and so he would not allow them to drink it. And the story goes on that this young man said, "Fellows, we think we're safe, but there may be enemy troops near us. We don't know what might happen this evening. If you get drunk, we all may be killed, so don't be foolish." So the officer in charge decided to refuse to listen to what the young man had to say. A few hours later, the company was charged by the enemy, came under heavy attack, and the men were able to fight well and escaped any serious harm or disaster because they listened to the words of this one man. Now, we don't know really what Solomon was driving at here in giving this illustration, but it's interesting. Many believe that this one poor man is a picture of Jesus Christ and the wisdom that he has to give to pull all of life together. And when you relate this with Proverbs chapter 8, interesting study, we believe that in Proverbs chapter 8, even though he's speaking of wisdom there, that it is a picture of the wisdom that is available to us in the person of God's Son, Jesus Christ. And so Solomon is saying we need to listen to what he has to say. Poor, and yet he is a wise man. When he came into this world, no one knew the poverty that he knew. And yet he is a wise man, the wisest man who ever lived. And we need to listen to him. I think we're going to close at this point with just an encouragement to you from the words of this wise man Solomon, and that is to seek wisdom above all other pursuits in life. Pursue, number one, developing a relationship with him, with the living God, and number two, daily spend time watching at his gates, as Solomon puts it in Proverbs chapter 8, waiting at his doorpost, listening to what he has to say by way of wisdom through his word, that we might be able to make the right choices, godly choices, moral choices, choices that will be fruitful for all of eternity if we make the right choices day in and day out. We can only do that as we're drawing upon his strength, his resources, his wisdom as we have it in his word. Let's pray.